say something about the borders?
Yes, of course, yes.
Right, good evening, Mr. Dar, Croeso, welcome. And we have some guests that we want to give a particular welcome to, John Bates and his colleagues from Newington Green Unitarian Church, New Unity, and that is, of course, where Richard Price used to preach, and we're very glad to see you. I've met John on previous occasions to discuss what we might do in connection with Richard Price's tercentenary, the 300th anniversary of his birth, which falls in 2023, and we will have further discussions about that in the future, no doubt. So welcome all. And welcome to Paul Frame, our lecturer. Paul is the secretary of the Richard Price Society, set up relatively recently to promote and dare I say, revive the name of Richard Price. It's scandalous, really, that his name is so ill known in Wales and more widely, particularly in Wales, because he's one of the greatest Welsh people of all time, I think, and certainly of the 18th century. And his achievements and activities were very, very extensive and broad-ranging. He was first and foremost a preacher, but he was also very much an academic fellow of the Royal Society, and wrote on moral philosophy, was a mathematician, and is known very properly as the father of actuarial science, and our treasurer knows very well that that is the case. Was also very much engaged in demographic studies in that connection as well, in the economy. His advice was taken on the British economy of the late 18th century by Pitt, I believe, and others. Yeah. And he was engaged in work on the sinking fund and so forth. But he was also very much a political radical. Paul, I know, is going to tell you a great deal about him, more than that he was very much engaged with what was going on in the last quarter of the 18th century in America, the revolution there, and then just 2 years really before he died, the revolution in France. And it's possibly because of the reaction to what he wrote about France that he is quite well known in political science circles, because Edmund Burke responded in very outraged terms to what he had to say. But I won't say more other than to welcome Paul again and to urge you, if you haven't read it, here's his excellent volume, Liberty's Apostle, Richard Price, His Life and Times. And that's Paul's so far main contribution to the debate about Richard Price, but we expect much more. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you very much, all, and thank you, Lynn, for your kind words. You've almost given the talk for me now. But no, there's plenty to say about Richard Price. He's quite an extraordinary man. It's a great honour, first of all, for me to speak to the Commodorian, one of the oldest societies, Welsh societies. I've actually spoken in two buildings associated with the Commodorian. I was lucky enough to be invited to the Marx Memorial Library not long ago to give a talk there, which, of course, was the Welsh Charity School. Founded in part by the Commodorian many years ago. So my talk tonight on Dr. Richard Price, as Lynn was saying, is not very well known in Wales, not that well known. I knew nothing about him at all until 2000, until I read Dr. John Davis's History of Wales, where the first comment that you can see there on the screen, the most original thinker ever born in Wales, came up in the book, and I thought, well, I've done Welsh history for 30 odd years, never heard anything about this man at all. So I started to get interested, and that's where it developed. Other people knew that he was important. A formative mind of the Enlightenment comes from the Marquis de Condorcet. He was the secretary of the French Academy of Sciences and a big player in the National Assembly during the Revolution. And he was a correspondent of Price and knew his work well. Britain's first left-wing intellectual came from Roy Porter, Professor Roy Porter, who worked in the Wellcome Institute here in London and who wrote about 18th century history. I titled the talk A Paradoxical Revolutionary. There's lots of paradoxes in Price, but this, in his civil liberties, there are quite a few in relation to whether he is actually just a mild radical reformer, or is he actually a revolutionary? Does he support revolution in all its forms? And it's basically that I'm going to be talking about. And it is a talk, it's not a lecture. I'm not an academic. I haven't researched all the sources or anything. I know a lot about Richard Price, And this is basically about my feelings about Richard Price. And I think he's much more radical than people make out. But I thought I'd begin, since many of you don't know, may not know much about Richard Price, I'd begin with just a brief outline of his life and some of the work that he did. So this is a painting of Richard Price, which is now in the National Library in Aberystwyth, painted by Benjamin West, who was an American painter. Price is actually resting his elbow on a book called Samuel Butler's Analogy of Religion Revealed, which was thought was the most important book he'd ever read, because it taught him the imperfections of human knowledge. And the imperfections of humanity is one of Price's big things. He doesn't believe in a perfect human being or perfect societies. The letter he's holding is actually from Benjamin Franklin, written from Philadelphia at the time of the American Revolution. Price was born in Tin Tong, which is a farmhouse in Llangaino, which is in the Garo Valley, just north of Bridgend, off the M4. The house is still there, as you can see. It's currently up for sale with 28 acres of the original 30 acres. That was the farm which was run by his father, who was also a teacher and a priest and a dissenting minister. The house as it was in 2000 is as I saw it when I jumped over the fence to try and take a photograph of it before it changed. Unfortunately, it's been over-renovated, I think, inside. It's been completely gutted and completely done out. But outside, they've managed to restore it faithfully to as it was in Price's time. He was the son of his father was Rice Price. He was the son of the second marriage of his father, Catherine Richards. She was the daughter of a doctor from Bridgend, from Newcastle in Bridgend. And he was the second child, although the first child died quite young. And I've also highlighted there Sarah, born in 1726. She's quite important in the story in that she had two children. Price actually marries, of course, but he doesn't have any children. His wife was ill for most of his married life. But his sister had two children, well, she had quite a few children, but two of them were really important in his story. William Morgan and George Cadogan Morgan. William Morgan won the Copley Medal of the Royal Society for his work in annuities. He was trained in life assurance by Richard Price, who was also an advisor to the Equitable Life for 15 years, unpaid. And William Morgan was also believed to be one of the discoverers of X-rays. There's a memorial to him in the Bridgend Hospital X-ray department, if you go and see that. George Cadogan Morgan was a lecturer, a minister, a teacher, and a writer on electricity. And he becomes quite important during the French Revolution, as we'll see later on. Price was educated first at home, and then in Neath, and various dissenter academies in Wales. It was a dissenting family. They attended various academies, such as Bryn Thorach, which is not far from Llangaino. He went to Carmarthen. And Vivesa Griffiths Academy at Talbot and Beckenham. But his parents die in 1739, his father, and then his mother dies shortly afterwards. He's offered money by his father to go into business. He's left in his will. He decides not to bother, so he goes to London. He basically walks most of the way to London. He actually arrives there on top of an open-wheeled wagon, like a beer dray, delivering beer to London. He arrives in London and takes up lodgings provided by his father's brother, Samuel Price, who's working with Isaac Watts, the hymn writer. And he ends up in Pudding Lane, in not very salubrious accommodation above a barbershop in Pudding Lane. He quickly develops jaundice, probably through swimming in the rivers and pools of London. He loved swimming, which is possibly how he met Benjamin Franklin, who also liked swimming. He used to swim in a place called the Peerless Pool, which, if anybody knows, Old Street Tube Station in London, that's where the Peerless Pool was. It was called the Perilous Pond by most people because a lot of people drowned in it. But anyway, he went home to recover from his jaundice, came back, and he entered the Tintoretto Academy in London, which is basically just about where the modern Barbican is today. It's quite fitting that there's a pub in the place of it today. Price did enjoy a drink. We know that from his letters to his wife, where he says that they're toasting her good health. He also had a good sense of humour. There's a marvellous bagatelle written by Benjamin Franklin that he sends to Price, which is called The Essay on Perfumes. And this is basically about making farts smell sweet. And Price writes back that he'd been reading it in front of the fire with Joseph Priestley and enjoying very much the content of the bagatelle. So nice to know he had a sense of humour, because he comes across very serious otherwise. And I'm glad he had a sense of humour. He eventually he passes out of the Tintoretto Academy, becomes a minister. he ends up in Newington Green, which we've been talking about already with some people here from the chapel. It didn't look like this, it doesn't look like this now, it's actually been renovated in late Victorian times. But this is as Price would have known it, the Newington Green Chapel. He lived in 54 Newington Green, we believe, which is the house with the squared off top. And this is one of the earliest brick terraces still surviving in London. It predates the Fire of London. And there's a small archway in the middle of the picture there, you can see, which is where he used to stable his horse, apparently. He married Sarah Blundell from Leicestershire in Newington Green Church, which you can see in the top right hand corner. And of course she remained an Anglican throughout her life. He was a dissenter and a second class citizen in many ways. He couldn't take a degree. He couldn't enter into civil society without taking oaths that he didn't agree with. He had to pay tithes to the Anglican Church, which he didn't agree with. But he let his wife stay as an Anglican, which is in contrast to Edmund Burke, whose wife had to change her religion on a marriage to Burke. And toleration, religious toleration, is a big thing in Price's life, and he was involved in campaigns to try and achieve religious toleration for dissenters and other groups. There was quite a dissenting radical community in Newington Green, and he was visited there by many other radicals and dissenters. John Howard was one of his big friends who lived in Newington Green. John Howard, the prison reform, you've all heard of the Howard League, I'm sure. But there's an interesting link to this building through John Howard. Price received a letter from John Howard saying he did not want any sort of memorial to him. There was a campaign to build a memorial to him during his lifetime, a statue or a painting or a collection for his prison reform work. And being a Quaker, he did not want any sort of memorial at all. And the man charged with actually starting the memorial fund was Dr. John Coakley Lettsom, who's the founder of the Medical Society in whose building we are meeting today. And of course, this is the Lettsom building. And he was a correspondent of Richard Price. Joseph Priestley was a very close friend of Richard Price, one of his closest. Price edited a lot of his works on electricity, his works on vision, were all edited by Price. He also edited all of John Howard's works. And many people think he actually substantially rewrote large parts of it because John Howard was abroad most of the time on his prison reform work. Mary Wollstonecraft, another famous resident of Newington Green, he helped her establish her school in Newington Green. He funded her and tried to find her work, and she called him the sage, which shows how much she appreciated his help. And Benjamin Franklin, of course, was probably his closest friend. He visited regularly in Newington Green, and knew Price probably from the Royal Society, where they were both members. I can't go into everything about Price tonight, it's impossible. I've just listed the sort of things he did around the outside of this. I mean, he published over 40 works in his lifetime. Plus, when you think of that, on top of thousands of letters, there are 3 volumes of his correspondence published. He wrote hundreds of sermons. It's an extraordinary output when you think of it. This is all in multiple editions. His books came out in multiple editions. He was a dissenting minister, theologian. His first book was on moral philosophy, which is still being taught now in Oxford this year, as I know, in a course at Oxford University. He was involved in social reforms, trying to establish old age pensions, all of which were voted down by Parliament. He was a demographer on population studies. And his scientific work, I mean, he's very famous for the Bayes probability theorem, which is the foundation of modern statistics and computing. And John Tucker, Professor John Tucker from Swansea University, gave a talk on that in Cardiff to the Commodorium not long ago. And if you're interested in that side of things, there's a paper coming out in the Transactions of the Royal Society, I think within the next few months, which will tell you more about his position in science. For all this work that he did, he received a lot of honours during his lifetime. He was a Fellow of the Royal Society for his works in philosophy and mathematics. He was invited to America by the American Congress. This is at the height of the American War of Independence, which was quite a dangerous thing to have to happen, I would think. They asked him to go across. He wrote a lot on the national debt and annuities, insurance, and they knew about his financial work, so they asked him to cross to be essentially their first Treasury Secretary. Sadly, he had to decline because of age, ill health, and his wife's ill health, so he didn't actually go. He had an honorary doctorate from Yale in company with George Washington. Only 2 people on that day got an honorary degree. One was Richard Price and the other was George Washington, with whom he was also corresponding because he sent pamphlets to George Washington. And he was elected a member of the American Philosophical Society and the Society for the Abolition of Slavery. And we'll come back to slavery a bit later on. But obviously he was very involved in the radical agenda of the 18th century. Principally reform of the Parliament. He wanted shorter parliamentary terms, abolishing the rotten boroughs and the placemen that were put into Parliament by ministers and by the King. Extension of the franchise, not universal extension of the franchise. He doesn't mention women at all, I'm afraid, but he does mention all men, but still with a sort of poverty qualification for the vote, but a much wider franchise than was currently the case. Religious toleration, he's definitely a supporter of religious toleration. He was involved in two campaigns to try and get dissenter equality, both of which failed. And he largely gives up after that, but he wanted religious toleration not only for dissenters, but for Muslims, Jews. He mentions all this in his letters. Separation of church and state is fairly obvious, and the social reforms I mentioned, the old age pensions, annuities for widows, all of these things he wanted to establish. Usually they were voted down in the Lords. The Commons sometimes passed them, but the Lords voted them down, and usually the bishops, because they thought it would make people lazy if they had old age pensions. But he's obviously involved in the radical agenda, and there's radical language in a lot of his writings. Four Dissertations is basically a moral philosophy and theological work. He's writing on providence, on prayer, and various other things. It's in this book that he actually takes David Hume to task on the idea of miracles, which is a long and complicated argument, which I won't go into because I don't fully understand it myself. But this is still actually talked about today. If you go on the web, you can find lots of reference to Price and David Hume and miracles. But there are in these books very radical language, which is the scheme of government maybe imagined by annihilating poverty and reducing mankind to their natural equality, which has a sort of Marxian ring about it. So you can see that the views are radical, whether they're revolutionary is another thing altogether, or the inciting revolution. One of his major works on insurance and annuities was Observation on Reversionary Payments. That's this volume, published in 1771. This went through five editions during his lifetime. It was expanded into two volumes. But again, you can see these radical statements that he's making. And this one was actually picked up by Marx. Marx used Price about four or five times in Das Kapital. Not always in agreement with Price, sometimes he disagreed with him completely. But he did champion him as a champion of the working class. He actually uses those terms, which of course I don't think Price would have recognised, but that's what he called him. So we're going to talk about whether he was how radical he was, whether he was a revolutionary. The background to his life, for the first part of his life, it's basically war is the background to his life. And one of these, of course, the Jacobite Rebellion, comes quite close to home in 1745. He's living in Newington Green, and I think it's Finsbury Park is where they mustered the troops to go off to fight the Jacobites and march down through Derby. I think there's a famous Hogarth painting of the troops mustering at Finsbury Park. So that came quite close to his own abode. And of course, when they captured some of the Jacobite rebels and executed them and put the heads on the spikes at Temple Bar, which he would have seen. But the main crux of the main time of his life was revolution. You know, the background to his life is revolution. It begins obviously with the American Revolution, the first one. There's a revolution in Geneva, which he writes about and actually supports. The Dutch Patriot Revolution, he was actually in close correspondence with Baron van der Capellen, who was the leader of the Dutch Patriot Revolution, and again, in support of the revolution. The revolt of the Belgians, he mentions, and of course, ultimately, the French Revolution, which we will come to later on. So I looked up the dictionary of a revolutionary, the Oxford English Dictionary. So a person who instigates, supports, or participates in a revolution. So what can we say about Richard Price in these terms? Well, he didn't participate in a revolution. He was asked to, of course, when he was asked to go to the Congress to be the first financial advisor. That would have made him a part of the revolution, but he couldn't go. He certainly supports revolution, and the question of whether he instigates a revolution or thinks he did is another question we'll come on to later on. But he certainly supported revolution, there's no question about that at all. He wrote a number of pamphlets in support of the American revolutionaries, in support of the French Revolution. Facts is not so much about revolution as about criticising the government of Lord North during the revolution, in financial terms. He thought it was appalling what they were doing to the national debt. Which he'd have freaked out if he was here today, I think. But basically the main writings on the revolution are the Observations on the Nature of Civil Liberty, the principles of civil government and the justice and policy of the war with America. And in this one, he lays out his ideas on civil liberty, plus supports the Americans in their revolutionary cause. He believed they were just in their cause. He wrote an additional observations in 1777. All of these were sent to America, of course, and published in America. In 1784, he writes observations on the importance of the American Revolution. This is quite an important one. This comes out at about the time that the Americans are developing their constitution. And it's basically written as a pamphlet of advice to the Americans on what they should do in their constitution. And the discourse on the love of our country is his support of the French Revolution. But there's a lot more to that than just his support of the French Revolution, and we'll come on to that at the end. I've added some quick quotes from some of what Price says in his letters at the bottom, where he was obviously in support of the American Revolutions. He'd be there, even if he went barefoot, he'd be fighting with them. He knew all the American rebels very intimately through correspondence, apart from Franklin, who he met. He did meet John Adams later as well. The first picture is of Benjamin Franklin. It doesn't look much like him, but it is supposed to be a picture of Benjamin Franklin. He's reading the Morning Post for the 1st of January 1776, and his fist is actually resting on a copy of Price's Observations on the Nature of Civil Liberty. John Adams, America's first vice president, second president, he comes to Britain as the first American ambassador to Britain. He's greeted cordially by the King, but the rest of London society tend to ignore him, apart from Richard Price and a few other people. And Price becomes very friendly with Abigail, his wife, and John Adams, and they visit his chapel. Price eventually moves from Newington Green to Hackney, and this is where John Adams would have attended his chapel. Thomas Jefferson, he knew quite well from the time of the American Revolution, and Thomas Jefferson and his letters become extremely important during the French Revolution, as we'll come on to later on. In Price's writings on the civil liberties, I mean, the tone of the language is very much radical reform, radical change. It's very Jeffersonian in its sounding, as this example from the Observations on Civil Liberty. Both men were, of course, influenced by John Locke. They had very much similar reading lists, and they had a very similar sounding way of writing on civil liberties, as you can see from this. So much so that a lot of people in Wales particularly have tended to suggest that Price was actually one of the writers of the Declaration of Independence. I've seen that said a few times, or heard that said a few times, which of course is not true at all. There is one French writer, modern French writer, Henri Labouchet, a moral philosopher and writer on Price, who suggested that one change in the Declaration of Independence was made under the influence of Price. We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable, was the original wording of the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. And of course, it was the sacred and undeniable was struck out because it was sounded too much like church and state. And self-evident was put in the place. Some people think by Benjamin Franklin, some thought by Thomas Jefferson. And self-evident is a word Price uses all the time in his moral philosophy. We self-evidently know right from wrong. It's an intuition. We know it's self-evident that there is right and there is wrong. And Henri Labouchet believes that this word was inserted under Price's influence. Whether it's true or not, I'll leave up to you. So there's a definite support for revolution in Price's attitude. Of course, the revolutions are all abroad. They're not in the UK. So the question is, what did he think about revolution in this country, since he wanted so many radical changes? This is one of the best books written on Price, if you want to know about his thinking and everything about Price, basically. D.O. Thomas, The Honest Mind. D.O. Thomas spent almost his entire working life writing and researching about Richard Price. But in this case, I tend to be a bit more disagreeing with him. He seems to suggest that Price is basically, if he is a revolutionary, it's just to modify our constitution as it stands. And that's the balanced constitution of the monarch, the lords, and the commons. And I tend to have a more radical and more revolutionary approach than D.O. Thomas to this question. But Price himself definitely did want to modify the constitution, as D.O. Thomas argues, in the UK. So we're talking about the UK again, not abroad. These are just two quotes from some of Richard Price's works. He denied being a Democrat. As did most people at that time, because democracy had a different meaning in the 18th century. It gave up visions of mobs and unruly society. which nobody wanted. It wasn't a democracy in terms of we know it today. But the second quote is quite interesting. He denounced being a Republican, which is quite extraordinary in some ways when you actually look at his important observations on the importance of the American Revolution. I mean, Price advocates a lot of things in this paper, which he sent to the Americans as a guide for their constitutional discussions. He wanted a regular census. He was an advocate for this in the UK. The Americans actually put it in their constitution about 20 years before we had a census in this country. He wanted greater power to the Congress and the federal institutions. That's an American issue. An end to slavery as soon as humanly possible. Price advocated anti-slavery all through his life. There's just an interesting side story that we might be interested in this, that basically Price, his nephew George Cadogan Morgan, who I mentioned earlier, had a son called Richard Price Morgan. He was born in the year that Price died, hence his name, presumably. He in turn had a son called Richard Price Morgan Jr. All this family emigrated to the United States in 1805 because of the Pitt repressions which come in after the French Revolution. So they all end up in Massachusetts. Richard Price Morgan Jr. is in Bloomington, Illinois one night in a hotel, and the place is full. So he hears a kerfuffle downstairs and looks across the balcony down at the front door, and there's this very tall gentleman standing in the doorway, which the landlady is telling is the room. The place is full, there's no rooms left. So he says, oh, the gentleman can come and share my room. And that gentleman turns out to be Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And that's a true story, because there's letters between Richard Price Morgan Jr. and Abraham Lincoln. Richard Price Morgan Jr. ends up fighting as a colonel in the Civil War to end the slavery that his namesake passionately opposed. Guarding against an unequal distribution of property and wealth, we saw earlier about Price's ideas about property and wealth and what he thought about that. But the key one for talking about this revolutionary attitude and the fact that he denies being a Republican is that he also wanted the abolition of hereditary honours, no lords, no bishops, and no kings, which is the words he actually uses. And I find it, I don't know how you can reconcile that. I mean, at home he's saying he's not a Republican. Abroad he's absolutely advocating republicanism. There's no question about it. And that is one of the great paradoxes of Richard Price. How can you do that? It doesn't make sense. And this is the actual quotations from the observations on the importance of the American Revolution. And of course the subtitle to the observations on the importance of the American Revolution is, and the means of making it a benefit to the world. So he wanted to see this revolution spread and be used across the world. The interesting thing about the observations is it was originally intended to be published only in America. He didn't want to publish it in the UK. But because people were plagiarizing it and taking it and publishing it of their own accord, he decided to publish it in Britain. But he didn't change the terms, he didn't change the words. But there is a qualification statement saying that Britain didn't have a constitution that was suitable for Republican government. Too much of the scum and the dregs, by which I assume he means the aristocratic scum and the unworthy poor. But I'm not sure whether that's what he meant or not, but I think it is. But it's interesting that he doesn't change the terms. And he actually uses the same words in an earlier pamphlet from about 1784, which was published in Britain. And he makes no qualification in that at all. He just says without lords, without bishops, and without kings, which is, as far as I can see, a Republican form of government. And of course, talk of these sort of things is now becoming more dangerous, more difficult, because France is developing into a revolutionary state. Things are moving on in France. And by 1788, Price is really keen to know what's going on in France. So he starts to write to Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson has been sent to America by the American revolutionaries as their first ambassador to France. And Price is writing to him to find out exactly what's going on. And I've actually handled some of these letters in America, and it's quite an experience. And this is the start of a whole series of letters between Richard Price and Thomas Jefferson. There's about six or eight of them in total. And basically, Thomas Jefferson lays out for Price everything that's going on in the National Assembly. The National Assembly has been established. He talks about the tennis court oath, the bringing of the king from Versailles. All these things are talked about in these letters to Richard Price. So Price is actually one of the best informed people in London at the time about what is actually going on in France. But he's also got a second source of information. Apart from Thomas Jefferson. Richard Price's nephew, George Cadogan Morgan from Bridgend, is also in Paris on the day of the revolution. He actually lands in France on July the 4th, which is an auspicious date to land into revolutionary France. But he lands on July the 4th in Calais, where the innkeeper tells him that everything's fine in Paris, just, you know, go ahead, don't worry, there's no trouble in France. No trouble in Paris, you'll be fine. So he goes to Paris with his companions. He's got four of them travelling together, and he stays in the Palais Royal, right in the centre of Paris. And because of that, he witnesses all the key events of the French Revolution. On the 11th and 12th, he visits Versailles and sees the King and Queen. He has really derogatory remarks about Marie Antoinette. But he sees Lafayette present the Bill of Rights to the National Assembly, which was adopted in August. But you can see from the quote at the bottom, which comes from George Cadogan Morgan, he was an out-and-out Republican, much more so in the Tom Paine mold. And of course, Tom Paine knew Richard Price as well, but he's more in the Tom Paine advocacy of revolution. In fact, he writes an anonymous pamphlet later on, when the French are thinking of bringing back the monarchy as a constitutional monarchy. He writes telling them not to bother and to send the king into exile. He's also there on the 14th of July. Unfortunately, he misses the fall of the Bastille because he goes out to visit some gardens outside Paris. So he doesn't actually get to see the thing come down. But he's back in the evening, realises something major has gone on, so they all go out into the street to have a walk. And the first thing they see is the heads of the governor of the Bastille going along the street outside their hotel rooms. And by this time, he's seeing people trying to break into the rooms underneath his hotel to try and steal guns and various other things, and there's riots going on all over the place. And there's Dr. Rigby, who is accompanying him as a Norfolk doctor. I felt our situation becoming a very serious one. It took him about 2 weeks to get out of Paris, and then he travels on down from Paris during the period of the Great Fear, when you have all the factions developing between the aristocrats and the ordinary people. And he travels down, and often he's bringing the news of the French Revolution to these people. He wrote a diary, wrote letters back to his family about this, many of which I managed to find in the Newbery Library in Chicago. And they're being published in the Wills and the French Revolution series from the University of Wills in Aberystwyth. Interestingly, he also wrote to Price. All this detail about the French Revolution is coming home to Price, telling him exactly what's going on, how the revolution is developing. He wrote two important letters to Price, which were published by Price in the Gazetteer, which is, I think, the official government publication. There are extant volumes of the Gazetteer, complete for this period, except for the two letters from describing the revolution from George Cadogan Morgan, which I find quite strange, but whether it's political or not, I don't know. But basically, Price is receiving all this information from Jefferson, who has dinner with George Cadogan Morgan in Paris. He's getting all this information back home, and he's absolutely over the moon by it. He thinks it's fantastic. This is what he wanted to see. All these changes that the National Assembly is bringing in, he's over the moon about. And then in 1789, November the 4th, 1789, he's asked to give a discourse in Old Jewry in the City of London, which is, I think, today the site of the Bank of China, if you go there. And he's asked to give a discourse in commemoration of the 1688 revolution, which of course is the William and Mary coming to the throne in place of James II, the Protestant over the Catholic. And he does so, he gives his discourse on the love of our country. And this is an absolutely wonderful sermon, discourse to read. Most of it is actually about what it means to love your country. It's about education and about how you should go about participating in your country and what it means to love your own country. And it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful read. It's only in the last two pages he actually enthusiastically supports the French Revolution. And this is the very last paragraph of the discourse. And he does so in quite ecstatic language. But we're actually thinking of recreating this, partly in commemoration with the Newington Green group. Perhaps recreate the sermon in the Newington Green Chapel, and perhaps in Cardiff, in Upton St Fagan, somewhere like that, in the chapel there, as part of the 2023 celebrations. Because it's just a marvellous read. It's worth digging on the internet. It is on the internet. Other people, of course, didn't think the French Revolution was a good idea at all. This is a ditty from an anti-Jacobin review. This comes quite a bit later. Price has already passed away, but you can see that people were worried about what he's actually saying in his discourse. Price knew Tom Paine. Tom Paine is actually recalls in a letter going to see Price just after the revolution, having dinner with him, and Price is over the moon. He's bouncing around the room in support of the what's going on in France. And of course, Tom Paine eventually ends up in France after he's written The Way to the Man, in which he defends Richard Price by name. This is, I think it's by Cruikshank. He's a cartoonist. It's not Mr. Gilroy, I don't think this is a Cruikshank one. This is the boudoir of Marie Antoinette. She's running off down the stairs to the other right-hand side of the picture. And the king is having his throat cut on the picture on the wall. And this is a reference to the October days when the king was brought from Versailles back to Paris, basically as a prisoner. But Price, of course, is on the far left, kneeling on the crown of France with the devil on his shoulder, watching what's going on, as one of the instigators, perhaps, of what's going on. But the main person who opposed Price and his views in the discourse was, of course, Edmund Burke, the Anglo-Irish politician. He received Price's pamphlet because the discourse was published immediately after he'd given it in the chapel in Old Jewry. Edmund Burke read it in January 1790, and he immediately sits down and starts writing reflections on the revolution in France. And when people talk about the reflections on the revolution in France, they usually talk about it in terms of Tom Paine's Rights of Man, as the start of the big debate between the conservative ideals and the Whig ideals, and or the revolutionary ideals of Tom Paine. But he was actually writing in response to Richard Price. That was why he actually started writing. So it's essentially Price kicks off that debate, which was taken over by Tom Paine in The Rights of Man later on. And Price, Edmund Burke was worried about two things in particular that Price was doing. He was worried that Price was undermining the British constitution, basically, in favour of revolutionary change. And as we've seen all along, Price, with his no lords, no bishops, no kings, I mean, that's essentially a republican sentiment. And Burke realised, of course, that if you start to change the hereditary principle, then you do undermine the House of Lords, and you undermine the monarchy. And that's exactly the same as it is today, since the British constitution hasn't changed in that sense. This is what one of Edmund Burke's major concerns at the time. He probably had a right to be worried, because this is Price writing to the citizens of the district of Quimper, which is in Brittany. Price was asked to, there was a commemoration in a coffee house in London, a commemoration of the first anniversary of the revolution in France on the 14th of July, 1789. Price was the chairman of the meeting. And he made a speech in which he said that Britain and France should join together in an alliance, and they should join together with America and various other countries to form what was essentially a early form of NATO in order to keep the peace, to keep the Atlantic peace. And the citizens of Quimper were so impressed by his speech and the fact that he wanted an alliance with France, they wrote to him congratulating him on the speech. He writes back with this, of which this is an extract of his return letter. And if you read, the governing power in every nation ought to be not the will of any man or classes of men pretending to hereditary rights, but the collected wisdom of the nation drawn from the general mass. Well, that's exactly what Burke was worried about. What Price is saying, basically, hereditary rights shouldn't play any part in the British Constitution. And I can't see anything that it means anything else, despite what people are saying about how he's just trying to reform the Constitution. He's trying to reform it in a particular way that was, in effect, a revolution, an overturning of the constitution. The second thing that Edmund Burke was worried about was the fact that Price was actually trying to get people to do it now. He was giving this talk, and this is an extract that Burke includes in his Reflections on the Revolution in France. But the second paragraph is actually Price speaking with emphasis added by Edmund Burke. And you can see, I mean, the consideration of the favourableness of the present times to all exertions in the cause of liberty, which is basically saying, let's get on with it, boys. And again, Burke has justifiable cause to be worried about Price in this sense. This is Price writing much earlier in 1784. Thomas MacDougall was in charge of the Committee of the Citizens of Edinburgh. The citizens of Edinburgh were trying to change their own local government in Scotland at the time, trying to get reform. And not succeeding, and Price writes a letter in support to them. And this is a quotation from that letter in support of the citizens of Edinburgh. So So he wasn't afraid of revolution. He wasn't afraid of fundamental change. And of course, he supports the American Revolution from start to finish, not like many people in Britain who decided to abandon it once the violence started. Yeah, Price actually kept going. This is Price to Benjamin Franklin, again in 1784. And in this case, he's talking about dissolving all governments, a convulsion, in order to erect a new frame. Well, I can't see that as anything other than a revolutionary idea. I mean, what else, what is the convulsion otherwise? It has to be some form of mass protest or overturning of what's currently in place. He's also writing to the Comte de Mirabeau. Comte de Mirabeau was a key player in the National Assembly in France. He translates Price's observations on the importance of the American Revolution into French, as Baron van der Capellen translated most all of Price's works into Dutch for the Dutch rebels. And in this, Price is basically saying he wants to see the revolution spread across Europe. Does he mean Britain as well, for being part of Europe? I think he did. I think he meant everywhere myself, but he wouldn't have actually put that into words, I don't think. But he's basically saying that revolution is a good thing. This is what we want. And this is, an important one. He's writing to Thomas Jefferson. This is just after the revolution. So you've got the 14th of July is the actual revolution, this is the 3rd of August. And he's talking about monarchy in Britain and France. And we all know that France had an absolute monarchy, which is partly why the revolution occurred. But he's hinting here that he thinks the British monarchy is an absolute monarchy. This is disguised monarchy, disguised absolutism. But I don't see how you can read this in any other way than he's saying that he thinks that the king's power is too high, too much. Just after that, he's in another meeting in another coffee house. He's in a lot of coffee houses during this time. And this is the next Revolution Society of 1688 meeting in November 1790. And this Price is also in the chair. And he basically climbs onto the table despite his rheumatics and offers up a toast. The Parliament of Britain may become a national assembly. And again, D.O. Thomas says this is an example of Price's unmeasured and unqualified enthusiasm for the recent events in France, which is true. I mean, Price, he does go overboard sometimes on his welcoming of these events. But in the tone of which he's writing, I'm as a generally a cool and rational man, as you'll see somebody else say later on, I just don't believe that he didn't know what he was saying. He knew absolutely what he was saying. And especially when you think about what the National Assembly had done before he made that toast, that the British Parliament should become a National Assembly. The abolition of feudalism and privileges, the abolition of nobility had already taken place. And there's no way that Price didn't know that these things had happened because he was on the corresponding committee of the Revolution Society who were writing letters back and forth to the revolutionaries in France. So he knew exactly what was going on. But again, we have a paradox. We have the attitude of his contemporaries shortly after Price has died. We have this Christopher Wyville. He was a landowner, so he had his own agenda anyway, but he was a supporter of a degree of parliamentary reform, and he's the one who describes Price as a cool and rational man. He wasn't given to extravagant statements or getting overly exaggerated. And he wisely preferred safe and progressive improvement to the doubtful event of a great but hazardous revolution. True, Price preferred progressive change if it could be done, but he was not opposed to revolution if it was needed. He felt if fundamental change couldn't be achieved, then revolution was the inevitable consequence. And he doesn't back away from that in any shape or form. This is Christopher Wyville again. He writes a defence of Dr. Price and the reformers in England in 1792. And in this you can actually see him suggesting that Price didn't want anything to do with the French Constitution. It was not something that was part of his agenda for Britain. And that is patently not true. Because when you actually look in the Declaration of Rights, this is the fourth edition of the Discourse on Love of Country that Price publishes, and he appended the Declaration of Rights, which is the foundation of the French Constitution that's being passed by the National Assembly, in his pamphlet. And it's basically, he says, this is what I'm saying in my own pamphlet. So how he can say that the Constitution of France was of no interest or no relevance to his thinking and what he wanted to see in Britain is just not possible. So we've got these paradoxes of the man's being seen as just a gentle radical by some people, being seen as a revolutionary by Edmund Burke, and a passionate revolutionary who wants change almost immediately. And the only way I can explain the attitude of Price is that he was a public radical and a private revolutionary. And I just give the example of another Welshman, well, Anglo-Welshman, Sir William Jones, the son of William Jones of Anglesey, the pie sign man, the great linguist, also known as Republican Jones and Orientalist Jones. And as you can see, he basically says the sort of things Price is saying. He believes that Republican government, even though Price denied it, as we saw earlier on at home, but supported it abroad, it's the same sort of thing. He's actually saying, you know, I support this, but I can't actually say it. I think that's what they're saying. They can't be honest about what they actually believe in public because of the times they live in. And even William Jones was not averse to advocating violence, a violent revolution in terms of what he wanted. This is another quote from one of his works. So I think it's just basically Price did not say everything that he wanted to say. He made a very good attempt at it, and sometimes he gets carried away and it comes out, I think. It's the only way you can explain it. But I think he's far more in favour of Republican and revolutionary ideas than is given credit for. And I think what he's doing is, this is from Michael Franklin's new book on Orientalist Jones, Sir William Jones, he's treading a highly sensitive ground between the politics of speculation and the politics of incitement, and it was very dangerous ground in his time and now sometimes. But we saw in the definition of a revolutionary, a man who instigates, supports, or incites revolution. And we haven't seen anything about Price wanting to instigate or incite revolution. But again, this is a passage from Price's private journal. The interesting thing about this is it was not the public issue. It was written in shorthand and was only deciphered in the 1980s by D.O. Thomas's wife, Beryl. She spent a long time deciphering his incredible shorthand. And it's the last part of it. I mean, when she said, I exult in the hope that possibly I may have contributed a little towards producing and confirming it, talking about the French Revolution. And I think you can't have more obvious an incitement to revolution than that, than the belief that he's been part of the development of it. Hence, I think he was basically a revolutionary. And it's at that point I was going to finish my talk. I don't know, have we got some time left? I was going to finish my talk at that point, but I don't like leaving Price as a sort of 18th century interest, just an interesting figure from the 18th century. I like to show the fact that he's still relevant to today and that he has things to tell us. Price dies in 1791 on the Battle of the anniversary of Lexington and Concord. He's buried in Bunhill Fields here in the city of London. He had a huge funeral. There were over, I think it was 80 carriages altogether, total. Originally the idea was to take him through the streets of London, take his cavalcade through the streets of London, but his family didn't want that. So they ended up having a smaller funeral from Hackney to Bunhill Fields. But there's another paradox in Price's life in that he detested factions in politics. He didn't like parties. He didn't want parties in politics. He was a decided Whig. He calls himself a decided Whig. But he didn't like factions in Parliament. He thought people should get together and have a debate for the benefit of the country. And that was something I was reading Swinney's People last weekend and I saw that quote, so I put that in. But basically we've ended up with the left-right debate, as we all know, which to a certain extent comes from the Edinburgh, Tom Paine, Richard Price debate. This is a new book by Yuval Levine, talking about the development of the left-right politics. The trouble is, I think that's breaking down. I don't think it works anymore. It doesn't work for me, because that's why I got interested in Price. I've been looking back to Price for new ideas, for new ways of thinking. I do not believe the left-right debate works anymore in this country. I've lost complete faith in British politics, or politics generally, to be honest. I'm with a lot of the young people. but I just don't think it works. But I included this largely because I love the cartoon, even though it's a bit out of date now. But you don't have to look far on the internet to find a lot of upset and anger about the way things are and the fact that politics doesn't seem to be doing anything. It just seems to be maintaining the status quo. It doesn't actually seem to be really shifting things for a future that is changing fast and has got a lot of dangers coming up with it. So we're back to the same question of reform or revolution. What's needed, as thought into this book, is a philosophical intelligence of the state of the world, so that we can have control of the social choices we make. I mean, often we don't seem to have control of our choices anymore. I think to a certain extent our democracy is being kidnapped by money and various other things. Mm-hmm. That's the way it feels to me. I can't, you know, I'm 65, so what young people must feel, I don't know. But Price had a broader vision. He had a much broader vision of how things should be. He considered himself a citizen of the world, unlike Theresa May. And I don't put up that because she's a conservative, I put it up just because of the statements she made, which I don't agree with. But he considered himself a citizen of the world. And he had a philosophy that I think is valuable to the world, which is universal benevolence. It all sounds hopelessly utopian, and he was accused of being a utopian by some people in his life. But for me, it's a powerful tool for changing the way people think about things. And I think you can see it working. You can see it actually happening today. I mean, we all worry about fair trade coffee. That's a universal benevolence for people who are growing the coffee in dire circumstances. People making t-shirts in horrendous factories that are burning down and so forth. That concern is universal benevolence. And the last one is virtual reality glasses that were used in Soros. Is it Soros? Yes, they were the big conference in Switzerland or wherever. And they used it basically to try and get people to donate to the Syrian fund by taking people into the refugee camps in Syria through virtual reality, because it's much more real to show them what it was really like to be in Syria. And I see that as sort of this ideal of universal benevolence. This quotation is from Jeff Powell, sadly passed away now, but he was a philosophy teacher in Harvard, I think, who I wrote an essay on Price with. And this is the best explanation of universal benevolence that I've actually managed to find. And for me, it's important. I'm a geologist by profession, and I'm extremely interested in environmental change, which I know happens because I see it in the geological column. I can actually show you evidence of it in a geological column. The top left picture there is of Greenland, the fires on the tundra in Greenland, which shows the increasing scale of them over the last 10 years. The coral reef at the bottom I put up because when I first went to the Far East to work, I went to Indonesia, and the first weekend I was there, they took me to see this fantastic coral reef, the first time I'd ever seen one. And I went back to the same reef 10 years later, having not gone back between, and the entire thing was dead. It was completely bleached. I've also seen the destruction of the forests in Malaysia. You can actually see the boundary between Malaysia and Brunei is marked by the fallen forest, because Brunei doesn't have to destroy the forest if they've got oil. Malaysia or Sarawak anyway have destroyed the forest, and so the international boundary is marked by the fallen trees. And the insanity of it all is, the top picture on the right hand side there is of the fire, of a new fire being designed for a hotel in the Middle East, in which they're rebuilding a tropical forest in the middle of the Middle East in a fire, which, you know, well, we're destroying it right left and centre everywhere else, which seems utterly mad to me. So in the discourse of love of a country, and as I said, this is the one Price is remembered because of its welcoming of the French Revolution, but it's actually about how we go about loving our country. And he says we should be citizens of the world and to take a just regard to the rights of other countries. And I think that's extremely important. That's what he has, some of the things he has to teach us for the future. And that again, you can see happening. We all know that Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accords, but people in his country are actually taking action to not leave the Paris Accords. And this was the governor of California talking not so long ago. The bottom picture is of indigenous peoples from the forests and various other places around the world saying that they are the best guardians of the forest and should be left to take care of them themselves. Truth, virtue and liberty, the three things that Price thought were the most important things for any country. And I would hazard a guess that in many places those are under attack quite frequently, especially in the present time, sadly. But there was other things that he thought were the most important. And I think we can add to that, because truth, virtue and liberty and a degree of universal benevolence are going to be more than ever needed if we're going to help peoples like this youngster, who's from the island of Kiribati, which some of you may have heard of, which is in the South Pacific. It's destined to be the first nation state to be submerged by the rising sea level. Either that, or it will be submerged in this plastic mass that's been found in the Pacific. And the interesting thing is, oceans don't have boundaries. So who's going to clean up the oceans? It's going to be all of us. That's the University of the Netherlands. Diolch yn fawr, thank you very much.
Prices.
Absolutely, yes. It's
Thank you too for reminding us that he isn't just an 18th century curiosity. His thinking and his works have relevance today.
I think
that's very important to remember as we approach the tercentenary, because I think that will be a very important factor in how we celebrate his life and work.
I agree.
I'm sure there are questions, so please put your hands up and I will.
Thank you. Paul William, you mentioned Burke and Hume. I was wondering if you come across Jeremy Bentham in any correspondence.
Yeah, Bentham didn't like Price's ideas at all.
Right. Yeah. And my second question, I suppose, is, you know, on his bookshelf, would he have had a copy of The Critique of Judgment by Immanuel Kant?
I would assume so. I don't know. Actually, his library was put up for sale. His library went to George Godwin Morgan, his son, and there is a listing of all the books that were in it, and I can't remember, to be honest, whether that was there, but I would imagine so, because he talks about Kant.
Oh, excellent.
I'm sure he would, yes. Yeah,
thank you.
Definitely. Yeah.
I'm very interested in John Adams Jr. because I come from Ealing, and he lived in Ealing in a place called Little Bossing. Uh-huh. And some friends of mine at the Local History Society have just published a book of his sojourn, but no mention of Richard Price, because clearly they were looking at the local references to Ealing. Uh-huh. I wondered if you knew that his account of his, that he kept a diary of his sojourn in London.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
And that is actually in the John Adam Library in the United States.
Right.
But there is actually a copy in Oxford, in the Bodleian. So you might find that will provide some...
Yes, okay, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I couldn't find much. I mean, there are some mentions of his John Adams visiting Price in his chapel and having private conversations in a back room in the chapel, but there's not much else written about it. So yeah, that would be interesting, thank you.
My friends have published a little book, actually.
Yeah, I'll have a look. Yeah, so you can give me the name. Yeah. Thanks.
Fascinating. And I'm intrigued, really, given all he did, as to why he forgot Robert.
Well, actually, as I've just found out, one new reason why you might have been forgotten only the other week. You've got to understand that when the 19th century comes along, basically a lot of what Price says was the complete opposite of what happened in the 19th century. For example, just today, this morning, I went to see the James Cook exhibition in the British Library, and Price knew Cook. Well, I think he knew Cook, because he knew Benjamin Franklin and knew Cook very well, and they were both members of the Royal Society. But Price actually says that imperial building by discovery is wrong. And he gives the example of the Japanese sailing up the Thames and planting the Japanese flag in the British soil and saying this is now part of the Empire of Japan, or being part of Japan.
That certainly wouldn't be a popular view then.
Well, exactly, and he says that in about 1774, which is when Cook is actually going off discovering all his... doing the transit of Venus down in the Pacific. So he's opposed to that, and of course we all know that develops into imperialism. He's opposed to imperialism. He actually denigrates that. He's not in favour of proselytisation of religion. So you think of all the missionaries of the 18th century, 19th century, he would have been opposed to that. And the interesting one that I found the other day was I was reading Avion Evans's Bread of Heaven, which is the story of William Williams Pantycelyn. And there's a letter in there between William Williams Pantycelyn and I think Howell Harris, talking about the Arian philosophy creeping into Wales and how you have to keep the Arian philosophy out of Wales, which I'd never seen before. I didn't know there was such a problem. But Price was an Arian in religion, not A-R-Y-N, A-R-I-A-N. Yeah. So he was... So perhaps that's why he's forgotten in Wales as well, because he's not mentioned in anything. Morgan John Rhys quotes from quite widely, I think, from Tom Paine. He doesn't mention Richard Price at all, as far as I know. I'm not aware of any quotes. So it's quite extraordinary. But it's basically, I think, is that there's a combination of that in Wales. But generally, Price opposes everything that comes in the 19th century. He's actually opposed to British imperialism, evangelism, everything that becomes the norm, basically.
Could I just ask, as a supplementary, did he write in Welsh?
No, I don't know whether he spoke Welsh at all. I know that his nephews, particularly William Morgan, was fluent in Welsh because he could transpose a song from English to Welsh and Welsh to English on the top of a hat. So I would assume that Price spoke Welsh. His education was mostly in West Wales, where he could have had to give sermons, presumably in chapels and things, so I assume he must have. There are Welsh Bibles in his collection, but there's nobody actually says he spoke Welsh, and there's no writing surviving as far as I know in Welsh at all, sadly, but I'm sure he did. Yeah, okay. Well, he's bilingual, basically, that's what I think.
Any further questions?
David Lindwell. Have you heard of Joseph Johnson?
He was the publisher.
The publisher
at the time.
The publisher, yeah. He published a lot of Mary Wollstonecraft.
He did, yes, well. That's right. Yeah. And I think I think it's Joseph Johnson who gets Price to meet David Hume, because they actually have a dinner together, at which it's reputed that Price converted Hume on one of his opinions. He actually changed his opinion, but nobody knows what it was. So when it's true or not, I don't know. But they definitely had dinner together, and it's Johnson who organises that. And of course, he would have known him through Mary Wollstonecraft as well. So.
A lot of information we have from them is because of Joseph Johnson.
Yes. Yeah. He's quite an interesting character of his own right. Yeah.
Paul, when we heard about Burke's reaction, mm-hmm. and I guess that reaction and the similar reaction by other people who followed him is partly also responsible for Price's...
For his demise, yeah.
But so too might be this sort of sanitization of his views that occurred by people like Whitehill.
Which is basically, right, yeah, sort of what I was hinting at. Yeah, I think he's whitewashed.
He becomes either the object of derision and hostility, or he's
just a gentle reformer, basically. Yeah.
There's nothing there.
Really. No, I think there's much more.
Anybody else? Okay, well, I wonder then if we could all join together and thank Paul once again for a wonderful. Before we go next door for wine and soft drinks and meals. On Friday the 8th of June this year at 7 o'clock, there will be a Kinnear Harbour summer supper, and a summer's evening of dinner, auction and entertainment in support of the London Welsh School. And that's at the Inner Temple in Crown Office Road in the centre of London. And the guest speaker is Baroness Tammy Gray-Thompson. And I'll leave this flyer here, which tells you how you can get tickets. It's obviously for charity, so you need to buy tickets in advance, and you can look at that. I think there are a couple of other people who want to make announcements as well. First, Kira, do you want to say something else?
Just to remind people that the exhibition in which a picture that the Cumbrodorian had renovated is a central feature of this exhibition, it opened on Saturday in Anglesey at Oriel in this month. Our picture is called Taff. I'm very sorry that I haven't got leaflets. I was hoping to have leaflets to give you all. The exhibition runs till November, so if anyone's in North Wales, a little trip into Anglesey to see this fascinating exhibition about how the Welsh were viewed by the English, and how in turn they interpreted some of the rather unpleasant assumptions that the English made about the Welsh at internalising. It is nicely portrayed by an exhibition organised by Peter Lord, with the four extant pictures, of which ours is one, displayed, and various other artefacts, china and so on, that have been garnered from places like the National Library and the B&A. So if you are in that area, it's a detour that would be worth making. Goes on to learn in November.
Thank you, Kirby. I think Chris Edwards is also listed on us.
I just plan to highlight those of you who may not be aware that one of the BBC problems this summer, one of the problems on Friday the 20th of July will include some music by Morbid Llwyn Owen. And this year is the centenary of her death. She was only in her 20s, I believe, but her musical output was quite large. And I think it's great that BBC Proms have decided to include one of her pieces of music. I'm sorry, I only have half a story because I can't remember which piece is being included. So perhaps we can announce that next month. Yes. There is also a pre-concert talk the same day being given by, I think, the main organiser of Gregor Orchestra, whose name I'm sorry I can't remember. So it's Friday evening, 20th of July. I think both events are the other.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And finally, our next lecture in the Nadwyd Nesaf, Fionn Mar Jones o'r Ganolfan i'w chyfrwyd leg yn Neu'r Celtaid Prifysgol Cymru. Lecture by Fionn Mar Jones of the Centre for Advanced Welsh and Celtic Studies in the University of Wales in Aberystwyth. That's on 19th of June in the Welsh Government Office. It's not here. Our Welsh language lecture traditionally takes place in the Welsh Government Offices. And Fionn will be speaking about William Morris and Thomas Pennant, Cysylltiadau Cyffredin. So two prime figures of the 18th century and their connections. And we very much hope to see you then. Thank you.
Lynn, do people have to register in advance for that, for the security?
If yes, they do. I should be emailing members, but if anybody isn't on our email list and wants to come to that lecture, it would be helpful to know. You can write to me at secretary@cambridgeireland.org. It's very simply addressed. So if you need to make a note of that, please do. And we very much hope to see you. Now there is some wine and soft drinks.